everyone back present. Item 20, discussion of Manhattan Water Board enforcement program. And I think I know that there is a presentation staff, and why don't we begin with that?
Good evening, board members. My name is Scott Ferguson. I'm a senior water resource control engineer on your staff. I'm also the supervisor of your enforcement and special projects unit. This evening, I'm talking about agenda item number 20, and it's a discussion on the Manhattan Water Board enforcement program. We'll start off with my presentation, about 20 minutes, maybe a little less than that. And that will be followed by an opportunity for you to ask any questions, or you can just defer those questions to when you guys get to participate, which will follow a brief presentation by Chris Kerrigan, the director of the Office of Enforcement. And he's going to talk for just a moment about a couple of elements of our enforcement processes, some that you see and some that you don't. So following Chris's presentation, that's when it's the time I'm looking forward to. That's when you guys get to actively participate. I'm really looking forward to your ideas on what's being presented to you tonight, what's been presented to you in March, this past March. Looking for your ideas on pathways to move forward with our enforcement program, with improving its efficiency, effectiveness, and transparency.
Is this where I say, be careful what you wish for?
Yeah. I got a big wish list.
Okay. I really just had the last one. I have four on the list. Yeah.
So then, and then after we wrap up the open discussion, I will spend a few minutes just going over the quarterly violations report, and which actually has a couple new sections. Just as a refresher, why are we having this discussion about the board's enforcement program? We've been discussing a lot of information about during the past 3 or 4 months about the number of violations staff's encountering, the number of enforcement actions we're taking, how long it takes some of those enforcement actions to be completed, effectiveness of them. We've also had several experiences, several high-value liability cases, and some complex liability cases have come before you. We've had some settlement proposals come before you. And then also we've been operating now with the revised enforcement policy going on 3 years, and the SEP policy has been in place for 3 or 4 years. So we've had a lot of new experiences, and I think we've all concluded, both board members and staff, that there's a need to, and also now's the opportunity to, look at our enforcement program and improve its efficiency, effectiveness, and transparency. And so that's what we're starting to do. Also, to that effort, we're looking to have a discussion with the board to better understand what your priorities and ideas are regarding the enforcement program so that we're closer to being on the same page. And that's the real driving force behind our discussion that started in March. It's going to continue tonight and likely to continue on into the future. So, now I mentioned this evening's discussion, and that's a little more focused. During the past 3 months, staff's been working with the Office of Chief Counsel, the Office of Enforcement, subcommittee of 2 board members, and we'd like to bring up the entire board up to date on what we've been doing with our time and efforts. And then again, we're looking for input, direction from the board on moving forward, like your ideas. Where do you think things should go? So let's touch base real briefly on where we started, and that was back with the March agenda item in Lake Darrowhead. And there, I introduced a lot of information, and it was really captured in our document that we shared with you called the Key Questions for Discussion. And then it was, I don't know, 5-6 pages of questions, and it quickly became apparent we don't have enough time at this board meeting to really delve into this, give it the time it needs. And so the board created a subcommittee including Chairman Humphreys and Board Member Sandell. And they worked with Water Board staff, including advisory team members, prosecution team members, Office of Chief Counsel with Kim Niemeyer, and Office of Enforcement with Chris Carrigan. We've met twice since then. And we used that key questions for discussion document to get us moving forward. We've come up with a lot of answers to those questions, too, and those are all included as enclosure one of your agenda package. And we also think that those answers could probably form maybe the basis of another document that we're going to ask you about a little later called the Enforcement Program Guiding Principles. So we can delve into that a little bit later. Also, several key ideas and themes started to coalesce out of our discussions of these key questions. And they're bulleted in your green sheet, and they're listed out here. And I'm going to spend the next few minutes going over some of them. Objectives of enforcement was the very first question on that key questions document. I think it's a good idea to know what you're trying to accomplish before you go trying to accomplish it. And so we spent a little time with that one, and what came out of our discussions was our number one priority or objective is returning dischargers to compliance with either water quality laws, regulations, requirements. All with the idea that doing so is going to better protect water quality, beneficial uses, or at least slow down, stop ongoing degradation from continuing. We also looked at, in a more limited number of situations, typically dealing with fines, referrals to the Attorney General's office, that taking those actions in part, and it's in part, are intended to create a deterrent effect for future violations, whether it's with the discharger we're dealing with at that time, or for those dischargers that are out there watching what the board's doing, keeping their finger on the board's pulse, going, what can I get away with? What can't I get away with if I get caught? What's the consequence? And making those decisions. So those were our primary objectives with enforcement. We then turned our attention to hearing procedures. Now, this wasn't really captured in the key questions document, but it's definitely an area where we identified we're involved with, that involves you, staff, and we've had several cases where we've used our hearing procedures primarily with our administrative civil liability cases and our cease and desist orders. And what is starting to develop are a couple of different templates, and we see the value of using templates so that we have a better understanding of just what process we're entering into, and all parties have can gain that same understanding. One template that we're developing, and this one I believe is in your agenda package, all the enclosure two, is one for a highly contested, controversial hearing. And that's where everybody's lawyered up, and we have unresolved technical issues, legal issues, and it's the full-blown hearing. The other one is for something a little less than that. Maybe not everyone's lawyered up. Maybe we're just discussing and debating how much is this liability worth, or is the time schedule appropriate in the cease and desist order. So we've called that kind of hearing light. And what we're really looking at here accomplishing with both of these templates is including the information, number one, that will more clearly describe just what is the nature of this hearing process that you're about to enter into, of the actual hearing itself. How do you prepare? What do you need to know to prepare for it and to participate in it? So you're ready to go when it's showtime. Another thing we want to improve upon over our previous hearing procedures is providing a better description of the type of pre-hearing documentation that the board wants to see, to be submitted, so that you guys get what you need, and it's on target, and it's more focused. And then the other thing we really want to bring out is where's the public and the interested parties. Where's their role in all this? And that sometimes gets hidden in our current set of procedures. We want to bring that out. We want to more clearly define their roles and the timing and the expectations for them. All these improvements are intended to result in a more efficient hearing process, to facilitate the hearing preparation process for all parties, and then also to let all parties know, the public, interested parties know, where do they participate in here, hopefully improving their participation, increasing their participation. All of this leads to a more efficient process, effective process, and likely a process that results in a more well-informed board decision. And that's a good outcome. Those are all good outcomes. The other thing we talked about that's not captured in your agenda packages or anything is the time pressure element of the hearing itself. And the effect that that has had, we believe, on the board's, whether or not the board believes they've had adequate time to consider all the information, get all the critical information, questions answered, and within time constraints that are typically put around our hearings. And so what we talked about, a couple things. We've already taken one step to help address that issue, and that's we schedule now our hearing enforcement hearings at the beginning of our board meetings. And this optimizes the time that the board and staff have to consider the information they receive, develop their ideas, possibly make modifications to proposed orders, share those changes with the parties, let them digest it, respond to it, and possibly make a decision all within the typical two-day board meeting schedule. We also clarified that the board members also have the opportunity to reopen the board or the hearing, say, following closed session. You guys go into closed session, you have some good discussion, and three more critical questions pop up. Or maybe you haven't been satisfied with the responses to your previous questions, you want to take another shot at it. And reopen the hearing, accept new testimony. If we can answer the questions, the parties can answer the questions there on the spot, great. If they need more time, if the board wants more time, that hearing can also be continued into another board meeting at a later date. In between those meetings, additional briefings can be submitted. More thoughtful, thorough responses to your questions, all leading up to a more well-informed decision and with the time to take that information in. So those are some things that we were considering. Then we turned our attention to violations and enforcement actions. We all agreed that we continue to see efficiency in using the lowest effective enforcement action we have to take care of the problem, to return the person to compliance. And it really boils down to our informal enforcement. We can kick it out in a number of couple days, 3 days. Or we go to formal enforcement, we're talking weeks, typically. Occasionally we can really move on something, but typically we're looking at orders of magnitude difference between time to get an informal action out and time to get a formal action out. So we get real bang for the buck when someone responds positively with our lower enforcement actions. We see that we can also improve their effectiveness by consistently including some additional information in our enforcement actions, all of them, in fact. And that is, attempt to convince the discharger that it's in their best interest to return to compliance as soon as possible. And the way we do that is, number one, we clearly identify what needs to be done to return to compliance, when it needs to be done by. We next, in this enforcement action, identify what are the potential negative consequences of failing to return the compliance in a timely manner. And then next, we also point out that the violation clock is ticking, and it's been ticking since the first day of violation, and it will continue to tick and accrue additional days of violation until the person returns to compliance. This has implications with those potential negative consequences for failing to return. And then where there is where it's applicable, I'll give you an example in just a moment, point out that there's additional cost for continuing noncompliance that's independent of any fines that we may impose. And the example that comes to my mind is a discharger is discharging effluent that's not compliant and it's causing a problem in the receiving water. That problem's not going to need to be addressed. And the longer they continue to discharge effluent in violation of their WDRs, and it causes the problem, that problem gets bigger, bigger problem, bigger cost. So once again, return to compliance as soon as possible. It's in your best interest. We need to consistently include that type of information in all of our enforcement actions. And we just don't do it right now, but we're making moves to do that. Another one, the fix-it ticket. That's what I call it. It's actually a modified expedited payment letter coming out of our mandatory minimum penalty program. But we're looking to apply this to construction projects that basically repeatedly fail to put in or maintain their BMPs. So we have the threat of a discharge. And that threat of the discharge keeps staff going out there and out there and out there, trying to keep this place from discharging. And we don't have the resources to go out 8 times during construction season to a single project. And so we need something that will get the discharger's attention. And this is just truly something that we're hoping just stings just enough. And it's more embarrassing than anything else. And that is maybe a 2-3 page letter that comes with maybe a $500 fine. We're still looking at what that liability is. But something to catch their attention, and in doing so, we get the discharger to return to self-sustaining compliance. We no longer have to go out there and babysit the project. And in doing so, we also prevent the discharge from happening in the first place. And in many cases, when we're coming before you, we're dealing with cases the damage is done. Here's one opportunity we have to actually prevent it from happening in the first place. And so we're working on developing that. We already have staff has already drafted something up, and I'll be reviewing it very soon and moving that forward. So that's something we're looking at. And then finally, let's see, violations enforcement. Quarterly violations report, we've made a minor change to that, and you'll see it in tonight's report. And that is, you see violations for a 3-month period. Well, what's that mean? That's pretty encapsulated. What's this discharger been doing, say, the previous 12 months? Is this just an isolated incident, or is this an ongoing issue? So, subcommittee came up with the idea, let's incorporate this information into the quarterly violations report. Let's give that additional perspective on our dischargers. And then, so we have done that. We've included another column that shows you simply the number of violations the discharger has had for the previous 12 months. Now, some that have caught our eye, we've used the cover memo for that report to further explain where we're at with them, what they mean, are they significant, are they not significant, what's going on with them. So between the two, the numbers and the little additional information we provide, we feel that it'll help us better prioritize our enforcement activities, get a little more perspective and information to the board and the public on just who we're dealing with here. Settlement. That was a good one. We've all had experiences with the settlement process, good, bad, different, indifferent. And what came out of our discussion on that was we believe settlement should always be put out there as an option when we go into a liability case to settle. Doesn't mean we'll get there, but we need to put it out there as an option to start the process and see where we're at. We may be too far apart. We may never come together. We may go to a contested hearing. That may be it. But we will try. The other thing is, the water board has options, maybe more options than were previously understood. I know some board members have felt the option is take it, leave it. That's it. Well, in reality...
We were told that.
Okay. That's why you believe it. So, the board, in fact, has the option, the ability to ask for modifications, to ask the parties to modify it. And in doing so, we would also receive value in also explaining why do you want those modifications, what's behind those requests. It may help us immediately at that point, and we can go into a back room, talk 15 minutes, come back out, we're all good, and we move forward. We may decide we need some additional time. It may still be within the realm. It may be something where we don't think we can, but at least we understand where the board's coming from on their request. And that's valuable information. We can learn from that, either for that experience or for future experiences. Also, we want the board to understand that we realize you take into consideration the amount of time and effort staff puts into these settlement cases. It is tough. We want you to understand we're bringing forward the best case we think we can bring. But if you find it unacceptable, we don't want the fact that we put in a ton of resources and stuff to prevent you from rejecting something you truly find unacceptable. Do it. We realize that that's part of the process. And it may actually force the parties back to the negotiating table, and you may actually get a more satisfying settlement in the future. You may also get a contested hearing. We don't know. But what I'm saying is, don't use the investment of our time and resources as a reason to avoid rejection when you truly find it unacceptable. We realize it is part of the process. So, and we also we want you to realize you can always ask for modifications. You always have that option. So I wanted to make sure you understood that. The other thing we talked about, and this can help the whole process, is I put it up there, striking a balance between confidential settlement talks and sharing information. We all see the value of sharing as much information as we can regarding the basis and the background of how did this settlement come to be. There's also value in the confidential nature of our settlement talks in that it allows for some very open discussions to occur that have resulted in some very good settlement proposals. What we're trying to do is favor sharing information to the greatest extent possible compared to confidential, keeping it all close to the vest. And I know in many cases it comes across that we're keeping it all very close, and we're going to try and change that. And we're already seeing some changes in that direction of sharing more information in some of the documents that staff's working on right now that you'll be seeing hopefully in the near future. So I wanted to report upon that. Let's see. Supplemental environmental project program. To be honest, we've been very passive on this project or this program. We're going to change that. We're recommending that we change that and that we become much more active, that we reach out to our stakeholders. We actively solicit on an annual basis, possibly semi-annual basis, project proposals to be placed on our set list so that when dischargers come in and they want to propose a set, we have something for them to look at. We also think there's value in developing selection criteria for those sets. We see it on two fronts, in that people submitting the proposed projects have an idea of what the board is interested in, finds a high value. Do they value, say, I'm going to say, on-the-ground project restoration over a study? Don't know. But that's a comparison we could make. Do we favor ready-to-go projects, just sitting there on the shelf looking for money, to project design? Don't know. But that's something that we could tease out. That will help us get projects that are of value to you and that you are more than likely ready to accept, given the right conditions. The other thing is, it will help staff and a discharger work on selecting a project that you are more than likely ready to accept, given the right conditions. So it's value in there. Also, we need to do a better job of using our website to explain our SEP program, to help display the SEP projects so that people, it just becomes more user-friendly. And so we need to put some more effort into that. Those are areas that we saw for improvement. And then finally, I put pathways to improvement. I look at this being really staff level in many ways. And how can we help staff do their job more effectively with enforcement work? Part of it, we can come up with templates for our enforcement actions so that we're not rewriting the same stuff in a slightly different manner, which always draws more comments. It's standardized to the greatest extent possible. Also, we need to improve our use of our database and other information sources to track our projects, our enforcement actions, to help us prioritize who needs an enforcement action, who's coming back, submitting things, what's their track record. We need training on both of those and on all other elements of enforcement. We have a lot of in-house expertise that we can draw upon and that we plan on drawing upon. We also have expertise at the State Board and can draw upon that also and plan to do so. And then we need to use our website to kind of put our enforcement program out there, make it a resource, show what we're doing with it, let people see, is it being effective? We can sell it out there and we get support for it. Maybe we get more supportive comments and stuff about what we're doing when we go bring an action before you, because usually we just get criticism. That's who stands up before you when it's not your staff. But in some cases, it would be useful. Staff's always looking for it. Who else out there feels the way we do? Also, the regulated community, they need to see what's going on out there. What are those consequences? Is the enforcement program sticking to their guns, seeing it all the way through when they find someone that needs enforcement? And or do they go partway through and they get distracted and go somewhere else? It all goes to developing a very effective enforcement program, and we need to use our website more effectively and possibly, like press releases, identify what's going on. So, those are the points. I want to wrap up with the four questions that are at the end of your green sheet. And these are the help discussion. These are helping me pull out some direction, possibly, a little later this evening. I'm going to throw out a couple of recommendations as I go through these, and then I'll wrap it up. So, the first question was, does the Water Board want to formally adopt the hearing procedures template? One thing I would like to share with you, we're thinking that we would like them up on our website for review by the public and those that might be participating in that arena. The question is this something that you want, say, the working group, the subgroup, to work on and bring back to you in a very polished way with, say, a resolution saying, here they are? A couple boards have done that. And they're published up on the website, and it's all very formal. Or is it something where you feel comfortable with, say, the work group gets back together and working with the subcommittee members, you're comfortable with them providing that oversight, and once the group is ready with it or satisfied with it, we put it up on the web? Or don't you want it on the web? Those are all things that we can talk about. Another one, does the Water Board want to formally adopt enforcement program guiding principles? What are those? Okay, well, I mentioned that those terms before. What I envision is like a 1 or 2 page bullet point document that basically outlines what is our enforcement program, what are the different elements, drawing heavily upon the responses to these key questions for discussion that are in your agenda packet. And once again, share with people what are we about with enforcement. Why do we do what we do? How do we do it? And what's the benefit of doing it? Things like that. And then finally, question three. Does the Water Board want to set annual enforcement priorities? Now, staff's been doing it at a staff level, and the board got more involved with setting regional board priorities this past March. And I would recommend that the board does participate in this effort, and it would be rolled in our vision to when we bring the overall priorities, just like we did in March, to you, and identify a set of enforcement priorities. And this is something I think we're targeting the February board meeting in preparation for our work planning effort leading up to the next fiscal year. And then finally, does the Water Board want to prioritize steps and or develop prioritization criteria? Prioritization criteria, the substitute selection criteria, which I've already spoken to. I recommend that we do go there and with the selection criteria. I think it's too difficult to actually prioritize specific set projects because each case that we're bringing before you is so different. Different nexus, different pollutants. It's hard to prioritize specific projects on a list. But we can definitely come up with some selection criteria. I gave you some examples earlier this evening of how we could come about that to identify what we find of very high value that, once again, would likely have a good chance of being accepted by the Water Board under the right conditions. We would also bring in the set policy and the enforcement policy and the guidance and criteria that those provide. That would be rolled into it, but then we would bring your preferences in and above that. So, and that concludes it. I would, as I alluded to earlier this evening, ultimately, like identify some future actions and who's going to do them and stuff like that. That's what I'm looking for. I'm hoping to get it. And if we don't, like I said, this is not the end. It's just the next step in a process I see continuing to improve our program. So I'll either answer any questions that you have, or I'll turn it over to Chris Perry.
Can I make a suggestion to the board about how we might go through this? Perhaps we could, rather than questions and comments, we could just see if there are questions about this presentation of a clarifying nature so everyone's satisfied that they understand what's been presented, and then hear from the State Office of Enforcement, and then we can make comments to both presentations as a basis for the discussion.
That's what I'm hoping.
At your own peril.
Yeah.
So are there any clarifying questions? Dr. Horn.
Yeah, a couple questions. One on the hearing procedure templates. When you mentioned, you had a bullet point about opportunities for public and interested party participation. Can you give me an example of that? I'm having a hard time thinking of when in any of these enforcement cases there's been public that wanted to participate. Well, let's see. No,
that's part of the problem.
In Kings Beach, there was public participation when the sewer main was functioning.
Yes.
I think also in Aramo,
there was Aramo, yes.
And I think those people didn't really know
right.
how they fit.
And that's what we're trying to get at, is that we're thinking that part of the problem, we think that there's probably more interest out there than we see. We might be misguided on that, but it's hard when you look through our multi-page hearing procedures. We never say public.
Yeah.
We say interested parties. What's interested parties? That's jargon. And that doesn't ring true to anybody. No, I mean, I'm reading that as Joe Public. I'm like, I'm not an interested party. I'm public. I'm a citizen. I just want to participate. So we're trying to bring it out and clarify. Interested parties, this public. This is you.
Yeah.
And this is where you get to participate and help.
That's great. I don't know how often it'll come up, but it's great. Okay. Second question is having to do with about setting enforcement priorities. Can you give me an example of what you're thinking of when you say setting enforcement priorities?
Well, I can tell you what Scott's been doing. It's been going into documents and stuff there. The dairies. So specific, let's go broader. Okay, we've identified one of our priorities is violations where there is adverse impacts to groundwater quality that adversely affects the beneficial use. Okay, talk about jargon and bureaucraties, but so someone's drinking water supply is adversely, they can't affect it, they can't drink it anymore. So we're going to jump on that. And an example of that I'll use as the dairies, as perchlorate in Barstow. We have nitrates also in Barstow. We issue the CAO immediately so that replacement water is being provided for taking care of public health there. That's a priority. Another priority is that we've identified our facilities, treatment facilities, or they are nearing or they're beyond capacity, and they're violating their effluent limits, not just flow, but they have water quality effluent limits, and further refining that are adversely impacting receiving water. So that's another idea. That's another priority that we've actually set in helping us guide our way. Another one could be someone comes in, destroys a perfectly good wetland, no permits, and just do the project. Unauthorized discharge of fill. And there goes the wetland and the creek, and you heard one of those, and you responded very well to that, those violations. That's a priority. That's what we're talking about.
Thanks, Dr. Olson.
Mr. Jerry?
No comments. I'm looking forward.
Mr. Dye?
No question.
Mr. Sandell?
No comments.
No question. I have no questions. Mr. Kerrigan?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yes.
No, I will. Good evening, board members. I'm Chris Kerrigan. I'm the director of the Office of Enforcement. I've been a director for a little over a year now, and I really appreciate the opportunity to address you tonight and also to have worked with your legal counsel, your executive officer, the subcommittee, and your advisory team members on trying to enhance your enforcement program in this region. It's been my great privilege to work with this talented group of people, and we're pulling together a lot of interesting thoughts. And I wanted to address to you tonight basically five topics, briefly, each of them. One is going to be a little bit about the Office of Enforcement, a little bit of background about what we do, where we're coming from. Second will be about separation of functions and what my philosophy is on my duty as an attorney to represent your enforcement staff. Third, we'll talk about settlements a little bit. Fourth will be enforcement objectives and my philosophy and the office's philosophy on the enforcement objectives. And then fifth is sort of odds and ends, which I wasn't really going to have as a category until I heard Scott's presentation and observed the board members' reaction. So a couple things there that I want to address. I took over for Reed Sato about a little over a year ago. I was a partner in a couple of law firms before that. I practiced land use and environmental litigation. Then for 5 years, I worked as a senior prosecutor at the Office of Enforcement. before taking the directorship. Our office consists of a legal unit, which has 10 attorneys, a special investigation unit, which consists of 9 environmental scientists, geologists, and engineers, and then a UST unit, which does underground storage tank enforcement, and a fraud, waste, and abuse prevention unit, which prosecutes fraud against those who would submit misleading or fraudulent claims for reimbursement against the UST fund. We recently, our first case in that arena was recently prosecuted in Santa Barbara Superior Court. One of the consultants, Hayden Environmental Inc., the principal, pled guilty to felony fraud. Will be serving 180 days in jail for fraud, which is a pretty significant penalty for a white-collar crime like this. He's also reimbursing the state for $2.4 million in restitution for those fraudulent claims, giving up all his professional licenses and not making any more claims against the fund. So the Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Prevention Unit is an interesting component of our office. That probably doesn't have a lot to do with what's happening here in the region or what my discussion is going to be about tonight, but I just had to give you that breaking news. It was entered on Friday, so it's the first felony conviction for any of the fraud cases that have been brought by the state for any of the funds. So we are working right now on several initiatives, and we're providing support to the region. My special investigations unit staff and my lawyers are all available to assist or back up or provide support for enforcement actions in your region, specific cases. You'll always get a lawyer on an enforcement action, and sometimes, if needed, you can request and receive technical support in the form of one of our experts who might be able to fill in or back up staff on a stormwater case or what have you. We're working on a sanitary sewer overflow initiative where we're trying to do enforcement on all sanitary sewer overflows that reach waters of the U.S. in excess of 50,000 gallons. Across the state, there haven't been enough resources to do those cases, and we have backfilled in the regions on those cases. We're also doing nitrate groundwater replacement water orders throughout the state. Your region has done several of those that relate to dairies and other nitrate contamination. Consistent with the state board's recent groundwater strategy, they're asking us to go out and identify areas where we can issue replacement water orders in impacted communities right away without compelling cleanups, but find responsible parties who are willing to provide replacement groundwater. And there are a lot more parties who are willing to spend the money to provide replacement water than they without resisting than there are those who are willing to do a very complicated and expensive cleanup. So we are identifying areas in regions 6, 5, and 3 primarily where we want to target specific communities, most of them environmental justice communities, whose groundwater has been impacted by nitrates. And then we're also doing a financial assurance initiative to make sure all the Title 27 facilities and mines who are required to maintain financial assurances for their corrective action, closure, and post-closure activities are up to full balance. And in an audit that was done, it turns out about 30% of the facilities across the state do not have their financial assurance mechanisms up to snuff, which means if they go out of business, the state could incur significant liabilities. So those are some of the things that my unit is working on and backing up the regional boards throughout the state on. And so now I want to talk a little bit about separation of functions. Essentially, the separation of functions notion is that considerations of due process require that the group of staff persons who prosecute an action be separate from those who advise the board on an action and an adjudicatory proceeding so that the board is getting neutral and unbiased advice in disputed or contested enforcement actions. For the Lahontan region, your staff is assigned an attorney from my staff to represent them, and maybe some technical support, and that would be for ACLs, but it also might be for contested cleanup and abatement orders or contested cease and desist orders. In those cases, it's important to understand my philosophy is that the regional board staff is the decision maker. The state board attorneys and staff are there to support your decision makers, and for us, that's usually Lori Kemper, but it's often also in conjunction with Mike Plesiak or Chuck Curtis. Those who bring those cases to us, they are the decision makers. We advise them on the legal consequences of their decision and provide them with advice and legal services, but we do not make decisions on adjudicatory proceedings, on strategies or on settlement agreements or on whether we go to hearing or not. In specific enforcement actions, my lawyers represent your staff and your regional board staff, and they do not represent the state board. And if you understood the ethical issues that govern an attorney's conduct, you would know that you must have an absolute duty of loyalty to your specific clients. So in this case, if there's a conflict between the regional board staff's desires and some state board desires, the regional board is our client, and we have an absolute duty of loyalty to that client. So when you see my attorneys come before you, they are advocating on behalf of your decision makers, your staff. And you can rest assured that they we're trying to give them guidance with respect to legal regulations, legal requirements, and state board policies, that they're making those decisions. So, in the context of settlement agreements, I know that you're familiar with the enforcement policy and how the penalty matrix or methodology works. You've exercised that policy yourself in a couple occasions. What you may not know is that your staff and my advisors work through that policy and that matrix when they engage the other party in settlement discussions. And when we go through that, we try to reach a settlement that we think the board would approve, the best settlement that we can reach, that's within the parameters allowed by the enforcement policy. If it's something that is outside, that we believe is outside the scope of what would be allowed by the enforcement policy, then we are going to bring it to the board for a decision, because we don't believe that we have the authority to make decisions that are outside the boundary of the enforcement policy in the context of a settlement agreement. Now, when we negotiate a settlement agreement, we agree with the discharger that we will come before the board and present this settlement agreement and advocate for it. We made a deal with them that we would come to you and advocate for it. That does not mean that we are disappointed or hurt in any way if you don't accept the settlement agreement, because you are the decision makers. And we have negotiated the best deal we can with the other party. But the other party, and the other party may need to hear from the board that that deal is not good enough. And that may cause us to go back and renegotiate with leverage and the board's backing a better deal, or the deal that you believe is a more appropriate deal. So we are never disappointed when a settlement agreement is rejected because it is not up to the board's standards. And my staff, you better not ever hear them say this is a take it or leave it deal. Now, you may hear the discharger's attorney say that, and they may threaten that if you don't take this settlement agreement, we will adjudicate before this board. But most of my attorneys like to do adjudications before your board, so that really isn't a deterrent for us. So I want you to really rest assured that if you see a settlement agreement that you don't like, it's the best deal the staff can negotiate without your input. But with your input, we may very well be able to get a much better deal. So in terms of enforcement objectives, I kind of wanted to talk about it in three contexts. As Scott discussed, our first objective is to get the discharger to return to compliance. That is always our job one. If people are returning to compliance with a minimal effort, you're probably not going to hear about it. You're probably not going to see them before you. The second thing I think is really important is that we must have a level playing field and neutralize any economic advantage that is gained from violations. So if public entities are deferring capital costs that they should be making, we need to neutralize that and give them a penalty that's sufficient enough for them to get funding resolved. Because there are other public entities that are not deferring capital improvements. They're voluntarily making the right decisions. And if we don't impose a penalty on those who don't make those the right decisions, then we're punishing the good actors. So with public entities, I have a different philosophy than I do with private entities. With public entities, we can assume that these are good faith actors that want to do the right thing, and they may just need a little prodding to get there. I think that's a fair assumption. Now, it's not universally true, but I think it's a fair assumption. It's a premise that we try to proceed on. With private actors, they're supposed to be maximizing their profits. So we think of them in a little bit different way. They need to be incentivized to comply on an economic basis. And so leveling the playing field is important. It's important to recapture economic benefit in both the public and private context. And it's also important to be consistent and to treat like situations in a like fashion. So if you are and that means over time, and that also means across boundaries. So it's unfair to punish a discharger because they happen to be located in a different region. And so it's important to make sure that there's consistency in the application of the enforcement policy and the methodology, while at the same time recognizing that there may be similarities in enforcement case, but virtually no two cases are identical. Outside the MMP context. But any of the complex cases, they all have unique features, and you want to be as consistent as possible where you can be. So these are the things that we try to accomplish when we work through the methodology and apply the factors and come up with a final penalty to propose. And so lastly, I want to touch on a couple things that your staff is doing. First of all, the fix-it ticket approach to stormwater violations is a new concept, and we're going to pilot it in this region. And essentially, we think it's something that we can work through consistent with the enforcement policy. And as Scott described, we can really get a lot of bang for our buck in terms of staff savings. And if it works in this region, I'll be pitching it to all the other regions because in concept, it's a really, really good idea to be able to go out and engage with the discharger, not have to go through a whole formal process, but to have already worked through the factors in the penalty policy and to say, if we come to your site and you don't have proper BMPs, on the first visit, it's $500. On the second visit, it's $1,000. After that, we'll see what it is. And those are numbers that I'm just pointing out for examples. Those aren't the specific numbers. So this is something that we'll be trying out in this region, and we'll be presenting it to this board before we go out and implement it. But as Scott indicated, the documents are being written now, so we'll have those to present to you. And then I want to talk about SEPs a little bit, too, so in my final odds and ends here bullet point. And what I wanted to mention here with SEPs is last year the state funded $19 million worth of SEPs across the state. Okay? It's the most that we've ever done. And it's important, I think, to funnel those monies to projects that the board thinks are of high value. And so if you work through your processes and figure out what is it that we'd like to funnel up to half of the penalty money that we impose every year into. In Region 3, in the Central Coast region, they have two major data gathering and analysis projects that are pre-approved, where any discharger who has even a small fine can funnel half of that money into that project. And it's an open-ended budget project. And so you can have a project like that. And those kinds of projects really prioritize the use of money. In other regions, they have a pre-approved list of projects where the board's already sort of vetted them and said, yeah, if somebody wants to fund this, we like this idea. and that's sort of a middle ground approach as to, you know, these are the ones we'll do, and these are the ones that you must do. But remember, too, with SEPs, these are voluntary. They have to be agreed to by the discharger. We cannot compel the discharger to engage in a SEP. And then I wanted to mention that we have very broad discretion to use SEP funds under the what's called the nexus requirement. So there must be a nexus between the SEP project and the violation. The nexus can be established in two ways, and I'll illustrate this with the project that came up earlier, the Squaw Creek Aquifer Interaction Study. That type of a study could qualify potentially as a SEP project. And it could, if there was a violation in that groundwater basin, any kind of violation that might affect groundwater in that basin, then there would be a geographic nexus to that project, and the nexus would exist so that you could fund that project with SEP funds. Also, if there was a program-based or a groundwater-based violation in some other basin, you could use the program relationship as a nexus there as well. So let's say two aquifers over, you have a violation of groundwater, WDR violation that results in contamination of groundwater. You could use that money because it's also looking at studying and enhancing groundwater. So the nexus can be established in two ways, either geographically or on a program-specific basis. So those are the remarks I wanted to make. Mainly I wanted to be here to answer questions and back up staff on any of the issues that you might be having and developing. And so I think I'm ready for questions as is Scott.
Could I make this suggestion? Can we do the same thing we did before? And that's to, at this point, just ask questions to clarify the presentation in your mind, and then we'll go to comments and try to weave ourselves through this material. So are there any clarifying questions, Dr. Holmes, Mr. Jardine,
no.
Mr. Dias,
no.
Mr. Sandel? No. I have none either. What I'd like to do is go to comments. There's a wide breadth of material and topics here. So what I'm going to ask, what I'm going to suggest that we might do is two things. That we make our comments, keep our comments prospective, rather than comments about things that have happened in the past, more comments about what we'd like to do with this topic and these materials. Number two, it's really easy to get involved in a discussion here that will chase itself all around the room. So what I'm going to ask for is a comment, and I'm going to start with Dr. Horn, and we're going to take that comment and then comment on that topic until we've commented on that. And then we will go to a separate topic rather than having five different comments and then branching off in all directions. So, Dr. Horn, do you have any comments?
I do, and I'm wondering if Scott could come back up and if we could get your presentation back up on the. So I really like the idea of being transparent and consistent with the enforcement policy, but I also really like the idea of having our enforcement policy be adaptive, because we can't anticipate everything that, you know, eventuality is going to come before us. So, I mean, this is the tension I feel. It's like, is how do we strike the right balance between being consistent, transparent, and being adaptive? So I'm weary of things that start feeling like we have lead feet. On the other hand, I'm weary of having no sideboards. So it's like somewhere in between there is where we want to go. Okay, here. Yes, compliance is the primary objective. Two, deterrence is really important. I would like to see third bullet point of punishment. In the rare case when a discharger has intentionally and willfully caused egregious water pollution, we have seen cases like that in our region, and I think in that case punishment is appropriate, and people should know that we have that arrow in our quiver.
Are there any follow-up comments to that?
I think that's a great idea. I am totally in agreement. You know, primary goal is compliance. And we do want to avoid future violations.
Any other board member?
I can only agree.
I agree. Okay. Let me check. Sample out another comment, Mr. Jardine.
So, I'd like to go back to slide 13. And you brought up the point of using the subcommittee to actually formally set up and polish up the process. And I'd like to see that happen. Like Dr. Horn says, we need to build in flexibility, but we need good sideboards, and having something come before us is really important. And I think we do, on slide 14, we do...
Wait, just one slide at a time.
Sorry. That's okay. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Unless it relates to that point.
No, it doesn't. It's the next slide.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Is there any follow-up comment to Mr. Jardine's comment? Dr. Horn?
Well, if we're talking about this entire slide, are we? Okay, when it comes to the hearing procedure templates, or maybe that's a separate...
Oh, that's it.
Okay. It's really... Okay, when I was chair, I almost always rewrote the hearing procedure. And I did that with two objectives in mind. One was that they be really easy to understand, so that just plain English, no technical jargon, no legalese, no bureaucracies, just plain English, and that they be appropriate to the case. So maybe that conflates down to basically two different hearing templates. I'm not sure about that. But I remember there was this one hearing where we had a rancher, and then we had a whole row of suits. And this poor rancher was like, I'm overpowered here, you know. So in that case, we came in with the howitzer, and the howitzer wasn't probably needed in that case. So that's my comment about that. And I can't imagine that by the time we work through all the issues that we have, that we can get it down to a one- or two-page bullet point document. But if you can, good on you.
Just on your comment on the template with the rancher and the suit example.
Suits.
Multiple. I think that might be one of those situations where what I refer to as our hearing light.
And
that's something we're working for.
Yeah.
In both cases, we definitely want it as plain English as possible for all parties. We see the benefit of that also. And what we're also looking for is standardizing what we can so that we're simply, so that there's consistency and we all know what to expect. And that we're simply filling in case-specific information into the template to the greatest extent possible. So that's what we're hoping for.
And then related to this, you asked us a question about whether to put these hearing procedures to post on our website. I think that's a great idea. I mean, so that it's transparent. That's, I'm just elaborating on my transparency comment. That everyone knows what our hearing
procedures. And then just to clarify, Board Member Jardine, you said you support the idea of the subcommittee group working, getting it, and not bringing it before you?
Or bring it back.
Bring it back.
Yeah.
Okay. So you would like the formal process?
I love your idea of public involvement, you know, rather than.
Mr. Dias, do you have anything about this topic?
Oh, I strongly agree that we should formally adopt hearing procedure tables.
Mr. Sandell?
I think we do need to adopt templates. I think that the great difficulty is going to be in getting them written the way that you could put them up on the website and that people who had no experience with any of our process could read them and actually understand them. I think that's going to be very difficult to do. I think we should try doing it. But looking at what we've gathered from other regions so far, you know, make you realize how daunting the task it actually is. Because what we're using in these other regions is just, you know, it's just bureaucratic stuff.
Understood.
I think we have a big job ahead of us.
Just something we've been talking about with staff as an addition to these procedures. Do a flow chart, to do a fact sheet focused at the public, to maybe explain it in a simple form. So we were planning after the templates to do some accompanying documents to make it more user friendly for the general public.
Okay. Mr. Sandell, can I tease out another topic from you?
Oh, besides the really do like the templates topic. because it's, I've been thinking about it for a while, and the difficulty of it. We could talk about the use of our website. I think that's absolutely an imperative approach to the public that we must make as much use of as possible. I wonder whether it's possible for us to get input from the public. In other words, you know, you can go to websites where you can enter, in essence, what amounts to an email, but within the website. So you don't actually send an email to somebody outside of the website that says, we'd like your comments. Put them in here. And what that does is not only does it give you more defined, you know, this is what you're doing, you're putting your comments in this box, but also can limit how much commentary you're willing to take. You can say, we'll take, you know, 1,000 words, and then the box is filled, and that's that, and it won't take any more. But I think that we should try to put that kind of a feature into our website and make that accompany our, as we do multiple iterations of getting all of this procedural information up on the websites and invite the public to contribute, but do it through the mechanism of having entry via the website rather than soliciting God knows how much in terms of material. You know, people could send you volumes by email. That's not really what we want. We want things that are a little more pithy that we can actually deal with. You know, if you get 10 pages, it's, you know, you might as well have gotten none.
And you're speaking to receiving comments on
we're working this through and trying to refine it and ask the public, you know, do you understand what this is and where and what do you think we should do to make it better than what it is?
Are there any comments regarding this topic?
Agreed.
Mr. Dias?
Agreed.
Mr. Dias, it's your turn if you have a comment about a topic that we have.
Yes, Could I ask that slide 14 be brought up? Regarding the question, does the Water Board want to set annual enforcement priorities? I think that we do. But I would also add that I think the priorities should be based upon potential impact to human health and safety.
I like that.
Any comments regarding that comment?
I agree with Mr. Dias that we should set annual enforcement priorities. I think we should keep the discussion open about what those priorities should be.
Any other comments?
I agree with Kate. But I'm open to other priorities.
Mr. Sandell?
I think I agree with you. With both. I take Keith's point. I do think, however, that it's inherent in the nature of what we're doing, that we're taking public health and safety into consideration in everything that we do. So I'm not sure it's necessary that we should be explicit in mentioning goals that we have to say it then, because that's just the way it works.
Okay, let me, in the interest of transparency, let me tell you what I'm doing here. As we reach agreement on each of the topics as they come out, keeping track of them to develop the charge back to the subcommittee about what we think is a good idea, what we think needs to be tweaked, what they should work out. So, Dr. Horn, another topic?
Oh boy, my favorite. Steps.
Want to go to a slide?
I have a lot of thoughts about steps. You can go to slide 15 for
staying right in one.
Okay, but I have all right. So I believe I agree that we should develop criteria for steps. And rather than prioritize a list of steps. So, to set those criteria. I spent some time looking at what we have on the website about that right now, and I understand that based on comments, well, whether it was based on board comments or not, in any case, potential SEP people are finding it easier to list the SEP with the Water Board. So kudos to whoever made it easier, because it's...
I think it was more education than anything else. Really done anything.
Oh, well, they said it took less time for them to submit a SEP. Somehow they thought it was easier. Anyway, good on you for that. I also noticed that a lot of the SEPs listed were credited to Fleur de Lac and Red Dog. And those, as I recall, were funds that were established prior to the development of the SEP policy.
That's true.
But I like that approach. And I'm wondering if... No, but I like the approach of Fleur de Lac and Red Dog, as opposed to some of the other ways we've handled SEPs, where it's all handled at once as the settlement. So instead, a fund was set up that was used for specific purposes, and then as the need arose, where someone had a project that fit with the criteria of that fund, they could apply for those funds. And I'm wondering whether we still have the option to do that.
Chris has an answer.
Yes.
Yay!
We still have the option to do that. We just need to go through and set it up in advance. And then once the vehicle is established, then it can be funded as you go from from ongoing enforcement actions.
Okay.
And that's the Region 3 model. That's the Central Coast model. They have an established fund. They have a work list. an annual work project list, and then as the funds come in, the various components of the project get incrementally funded.
No, this is the reverse.
Chris, who does that work?
Does what work?
For Region 3, who?
Oh, it's the.
There's two projects.
Yeah, there's two projects. I can't recall the name of the project. The one's called the LID project. It's Low Impact Development. Monterey Bay Foundation or something?
Yeah, it's my understanding is it's a little complicated. I think one of the things we liked about the new staff policy was that staff didn't have to do some of what we used to do in terms of requesting proposals and ranking projects and administering, basically grants or whatever. But my understanding with Region 3, the two projects that they have, the project funds, one is in cooperation with the U.S. Geological Survey and the county, Monterey County and Santa Cruz County, I think, but primarily Monterey County, to get that project is about getting groundwater data related to nitrate in the Salinas Valley, where they don't have currently identified responsible parties, which is so much agriculture, and so they're trying to collect that data so that Chris can then follow up with orders on replacement water because they don't have responsible parties that are obvious. Right. They need more data. So that's an easy one. People write checks for and it funds monitoring party. The other one, the low impact development one, they have a third party so I think part of the SET money does pay for a third party to administer grants that go to local government for low impact development principles. I'm not sure they've actually funded projects per se, but they're trying to get the local government to build low impact development ordinances into their local, how they do business and how they review development projects and that kind of thing.
Okay, hold on 1 second. Let's call that the Region 3 model, but I think I heard you say, Dr. Moore, that you were thinking of something that we didn't just describe.
Right. That is correct, although I like that model too, and so I think that's worth exploring more, but what I think the red dog in Fertilac, what happened there, Chris, was a pot of money was created out of
the office, health and money.
And
I think what happened was the
hold on 1 second. I want to make sure that Dr. Horn has a chance to explain what it is that she is trying to describe.
Well, thank you. But Lori probably knows exactly what happened there. Pot of money was created, and then subsequently people have applied to the water. And I appreciate the staff not wanting to be involved in administering these things. I'm sympathetic to that. But the reason, the background of my concern about the way this stuff has is there was a case, and I think maybe you were there, that involved bringing a huge slug of SET money into a small mountain community with a bunch of different NGOs who would have loved to have a piece of that money. And it was, I heard a great deal of criticism and bitterness that it was basically an inside deal, that one particular person got it and nobody else had a chance at that money. And I mean, it wasn't transparent. It didn't feel just.
You have to think about what kind of a tool a SEP is versus what kind of a tool is to clean up an abatement account. And so SEP is a tool where a discharger voluntarily agrees to fund a project. And so putting money into a pool that then is tapped by people in the future who don't necessarily have an idea at the time, that's not going to work for a SEP. If those people have a good idea and they want to fund a project, they can go to the cleanup and abatement account, or you could support a request from the cleanup and abatement account, or they could work with some discharger in the future. So when the auditors audited our SEP project 5 years ago before the SEP policy was adopted, these slush fund type accounts were severely criticized for several reasons. But that doesn't mean you can't do that kind of thing. It's just that the NGOs have to be ready with a project, a budget, and a proposal. And you can do a bunch of them with one settlement. Like, we just did one in Region 5 for SFPUD. It's $1.6 million penalty. $800,000 is going to four different projects in the Central Valley. They're very different. So, because SFPUD was like, yeah, let's fund a bunch of projects.
Okay.
And that would be your list type of analysis.
Right.
Could I make this suggestion? And please tell me it's not a good one if you don't think it is. Or if you have other comments about SES. I'm hearing that we probably want to follow up on the idea of developing a way to define SES, one of which might be programmatic, which is sort of what I see the Region 3 model being, and then we would like to find a way to prioritize that, so that should be a charge to some committee in follow up on this presentation.
Yeah, I mean, I have many ideas about tweaking and improving the set things, and we don't need to hear them all tonight, as long as you put me on the subject.
I was going to say, I have a plan. I'm ahead of you. I'm ahead of you. After you made three comments about the same topic, you have essentially volunteered.
And I'd be happy to have a discussion with you and just explore some possibilities, too, you know, as a preface for the subcommittee in the context of what the other regions have done. Again, we did $19 million worth of SEP, so there's a lot of different kinds of things going on.
So we're going to make that possible. What I'd like to try to do, because it's now 10, is see if we have other topics that we need to work through, because I really want to try to get a comprehensive charge back to the working group. Mr. Jardine?
No.
Mr. Mr. Diet.
Just want to, I think we should continue to support Scott's proposal to develop a fix-it ticket.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay. Dr. Horn.
I wanted to follow up on Keith's support the fix-it ticket approach, and to which I would add, don't spend a lot of time, this is my advice, don't spend a lot of time worrying about the initial amount, 500,000, whatever. Pick a number, use it, and put it in the enforcement policy that we will review those numbers in 2 years to see if they are working. If they're not working, then they have to be raised. But, I mean, start at some number and see if it works. There's no scientific answer to that.
Any other topic? In the meantime, can I raise one?
Okay.
One of the tensions that seems to happen here is that we want to develop a consistent approach to enforcement procedurally, but also in terms of what matters to us and what kind of severity of conduct triggers what kind of response. And that, to some extent, that has the potential to be subjective. And so I'm wondering, I think we need to deal with the question of how inside the process, inside the staff, is that determination made that this, let's say we have a toolkit with seven tools, that range from completely benign to drawing and quartering. And I have an interest in knowing how the decision is made as to which one of those tools is going to be employed at a certain point in time and who is responsible for that decision. And so I would like to one, follow up on that, and two, I would like to get some feedback from the staff who are the people in the room who really do have experience in dealing with this question and making these decisions as to how they see that this the decision
and how they would go about making it. You know, I'm not sure how to do that, but consistency in response is really important because it creates a set of expectations in the community that we in turn meet. One of my favorite judges always told me that at a certain point in a person's probationary career, they were going to prison. And it really didn't mean, it didn't have a lot to do with the specific fact of that, but there was an expectation that people had to have that if they came back X number of times, they had crossed the line. And I think in a roundabout way, that's sort of one of the things that we've been wrestling with. If I have to go to your project 9 times, is 9 the magic number? Is it the magic number for everybody? How did we determine that? Or instead of arbitrary numbers, is there a way we can do a framework for that decision so we can see how it's being made, by whom it's being made, and by whom it's being authorized? So I would ask that that topic go back as well.
I agree.
Yeah. And did you find anything in your review?
In my review?
Of your top, of your material that while I was lathering on.
No.
So it sounds to me, to sum up, that we want to explore templates, how we use the website, and the creation of the template, and also in the process in general. An annual review of prioritization of enforcement priorities, actions, a thorough examination of steps, how they work, what the options are, as well as a mechanism for adopting criteria and perhaps ranking and priorities, and the fix-a-ticket plan and the internal process by which you guys make a determination as to how to proceed. I'm thinking, this is gratuitous, but I'm thinking that maybe the same subcommittee doesn't have to work on all these questions. For a variety of reasons. They're not all exactly the same. Some of them are procedural, and some of them are policy-oriented, and some of them really have to do with the internal policies and operations of the agency. So Dr. Horn has volunteered to work on SEPs. I'm certainly willing, and I can't speak for Mr. Sandell, but to continue to work on this question of procedures and processes. I'd sort of like the staff to come back to me with a sense of what you have, what you see as your array of choices, how you make those choices, and to get a sense really of maybe how you would recommend that we proceed to do that. We have had discussion among the subcommittee of what the toolbox contains. And so, you know, you might make that feedback to us in light of the new tools that we develop, and maybe we can have some return on this by September. I think it would be hard to get all the way back in July, but and hopefully you would be able to coordinate that. Is that workable?
We don't actually have a meeting in September.
Oh.
Oh, wow. God, like September just got colossally better.
You all have one of these in your blue packet. It's an updated calendar.
Wow. I'm so happy. Okay, so October would be fine. And let me just say one other thing. Having been on the subcommittee and the staff really, really worked hard on this.
Very hard.
We worked a little. They worked really, really hard. They got really great support from the state office. And I thank you. This is a big step. This is a really big area of what we do to reinvent and retweet and redefine. And I really appreciate the work that's been done on this.
A point of clarification, if I could just raise in the office. I don't recall the board wanting discussing should staff do guiding principles, and just like mentioned in case that was happening. I just know something about that was one thing.
Guiding principles being what
think,
at this point?
I think what I had envisioned, and this is what Dr. Horn was commenting on, kind of in dreamland, getting up, basically boiling our responses to our key questions down into a one or two page bullet point document that better defines what our enforcement program is. Just my two cents on it at this point. I've received a lot of feedback. I think we have, I would just put that, we're still defining some of those ideas, and I think we will further define them through the next few months leading up to October. Let's put that one on the side for now. We're not dropping it, but I think it, we have enough to work on now. And
I can't quarrel with that. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Item 21.